This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G, along with Dr. Doug Lyle on the Beat Your Genes podcast. So last week, we played the first half of an interview from Andrew Taylor's Spud Fit podcast. We got to hear how Dr. Lyle actually became involved with evolutionary psychology and how he came to think about these ideas that we talk about on our show. Now the interview takes a little bit of a different turn. So for those of you who don't know, Dr. Lyle is actually a well-known speaker in the health world, as well as being an author of The Pleasure Trap, Mastering the Hidden Force That Undermines Health and Happiness. So this week, we're going to listen in on the second half of the interview, where Dr. Lyle actually discusses what health has to do with evolutionary psychology.
Etc. But this is clearly a different animal because it's coming from a different perspective, which is human nature.
Yeah.
There's a human nature, and the better you know human nature, the better you can understand its struggles and the roots of its suffering. And when you do, you can engineer strategies that are much more successful than conventional strategies for reasons that conventional thinkers would never even think of.
Yeah.
Yes.
That story about the divorce is really, really interesting to me because while you were talking about that, I was relating it to my experience with food.
Yes.
So this whole idea of the potatoes, the idea was that I wanted basically it's synonymous with a divorce, I guess. Now that I've listened to that story, I can see that I had a relationship with food that was unhealthy.
Yes.
I was relying on food for enjoyment, comfort, emotional support. Because of that, I was making bad food choices. So the whole idea was to remove emotion from my choices and bring it all back to logic.
Yes.
And it sounds like that's basically what you were trying to do with your patient there.
Yes.
To help her see her relationship from a logical point of view. And that's exactly what I was trying to do with myself and food, to stop making decisions based on my emotions that I've had a bad day, I need some chocolate cake to help me feel better. I worked hard on it. And then I had this realization that all of the problems that I thought food was solving, it was actually causing. And once I could get that clarity of thought, then I didn't have to worry about making bad choices anymore because it was just obvious to me what I should eat, rather than having that, like, the internal debate was gone then.
Yes.
So
fantastic.
Yeah. So anyway, that was while you were talking about that, I was thinking the same thing.
Of course, you bet.
Hey, dog's come to visit.
There you go. Dog nature.
Yeah. Yeah, he wants to know what's going on, doesn't
he?
Yeah,
you bet. You bet.
All right. So, can we go on to the moderation myth? Then?
Yes.
Because like I said, that's my favorite chapter I've read in any book ever.
Oh, my goodness.
That was great. It just solidified things in my mind when I read that chapter. That was the first chapter I read of the book. I didn't read it in order like I was supposed to.
Right. Very good.
Yeah.
That was a interesting chapter because we had written the book and an editor had come back and said, there's kind of something missing and I don't know what it is, but it's right about here. It's something doesn't follow.
Yeah.
And Alan looked at this and said, he kind of came up with the notion of that moderation was something that we needed to explain and attack as a concept. And so then we came up with the myths of moderation, which is that there are false assumptions in the concept of the myth of moderation, or the concept of moderation, The concept of moderation has a reason why it is such a powerful concept in general, and that is because it is so true with so many domains. So many domains of human problem solving, the right move is to take a moderate position, because the moderate position reduces the likelihood of extreme error.
Yeah.
Okay? And so as a result, generally, you better have extraordinary evidence if you're going to take an extraordinary position. You better be extremely confident, and you better have your risks mitigated all over the place, or you cannot afford to take an extreme position.
Yeah.
So we recognized that in terms of human nature, the right thing to do is sort of computer check, which means we check around what everybody else thinks and make sure we're somewhere near the middle.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's actually
there's the dog
doing dog nature.
Yeah.
So this makes complete sense. And so this is why this is such a powerful argument against anything that looks as strange as the diet we would recommend.
Yeah.
That everybody's doctor, I get this at least once a month,
yeah,
where I have some parent, wife, husband, et cetera, usually a parent, talking about how they've got a teenage child or an adult child who has an eating disorder. And the problem is that the professionals that are talking to them are saying, listen, that vegan diet is part of your disease.
Yeah.
Okay? And you are thinking very strangely, and we have to fix you and make you essentially more conventional in your thinking.
Yeah.
Now, the truth is that the person may well have, I wouldn't exactly call it a disease. I would call it, they've got some screwy circuits in their head when they have eating disorders.
Yep.
And they are interesting circuits that I could talk about another day.
Yeah.
It's not a disease process. It's an unusual circuit arising out of a juxtaposition between a natural obsessive compulsive disorder and the modern horrendous social costs of people being fat.
Yeah.
That's how you wind up with an eating disorder. You couldn't have had an eating disorder 200 years ago because there wasn't a fascination with fat.
Yeah.
It's only a modern environment. In the same way, you couldn't have a hand washing compulsion
Because we didn't wash hands. Yeah.
Before the dawn of germ theory.
Yeah, yeah.
As soon as you have the germ theory, then the obsessive people by nature start obsessing about germs.
Yeah.
So in the modern environment, young women and women in general, but young women in particular, obsess about fat. Why? Because if you're fat, you lose status and sexual attractiveness. So therefore, if they're hyper conscientious, by God, they're going to make sure that they're not going to be fat. And now we wind up with an eating disorder. Why? Because if you eat the conventional foods, you will wind up fat.
Yeah, yeah.
And so as a result, what do? They restrict like crazy. And now that is, in fact, the genesis of eating disorders.
Yeah.
Now, so then they go to treatment, and what do they get? They're told, no, you're... And then once in a while, the ones that I hear about are the ones that are very fastidious about eating very healthy food.
Yeah.
And then when they go to treatment, they're being told, oh, well, you're out of line. You need to learn to eat chocolate shakes and relax and have a cheeseburger now and then. And of course, these people are saying, no, that is absolutely untrue. And they are digging in their heels, and they won't move, and everybody thinks they're crazy.
Yeah.
Truth is, they're not even the slightest bit crazy. And so I forget what your question is. I got lost.
Oh, we were just talking about the moderation, the myth of moderation.
Myth of moderation. So, this is exactly right. So the point is that the just because you're in an extreme position doesn't mean you're wrong.
Yeah.
Okay? And so it turns out that we knew, it was very clear to us that we are correct about diet.
Yeah.
Now, we can argue with John McDougall over a little bit of salt, and we can argue Caldwell also stand about a calorie here and a calorie there.
Yeah.
Essie wants everybody choking down a bunch of kale.
Yeah.
And we're saying we don't really care. So there's slight disagreements of emphasis among those of us that treat people.
Yeah.
But the truth is, we know we're right because we see sick people get well.
Yeah.
We see very sick people get very well.
Yeah.
And we do this in a way that every MD that ever comes to work for us always says, this is a miracle. I never see this happen in my practice.
Yeah.
And it's a joy for them to be a medical doctor and actually watch sick people get well.
Yeah.
And so we, of course, know we're on the right track. We have tremendous evidence that this is true. And so we know that our position isn't even the slightest bit strange.
Yeah. Okay? Yeah. It's just that it's so much different to what the mainstream is.
It's so much different than the mainstream.
People go, oh, it's extreme.
It's the mainstream that got crazy.
Yeah.
Okay. And so we recognize that the mainstream is extreme. that there is no diet that looks remotely like the mainstream diet anywhere in nature.
Yeah.
So we recognize that our diet, there could be variations on a, quote, natural diet that would be reasonable to debate and to look at.
Yeah.
People, the inclusion of meat or not inclusion of meat is a very interesting topic and open to empirical and theoretical discussion. But what is not open to discussion is chocolate shakes, donuts, ding-dongs, you know, licorice, and Coca-Cola. Okay?
Donut trees are not real.
You're right, exactly. And so we know, and so this is where we begin the myths of moderation, that of course you would want to take a moderate position when you don't know any better and you don't have any evidence, and you better just check the village, because the village is going to be the house of wisdom, and that you're going to try to head to the middle. And so unfortunately, we have a world of extraordinary ignorance in the very highest levels of academia responsible for training medical doctors.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's an incredible disconnect. I remember one young physician said to me, I have an enormous textbook on nutrition that I have to memorize an incredible amount of stuff. And I go through this entire thing, and yet nothing is talked about diet. Diet isn't even discussed. Now, they know a tremendous amount about the cell biology of what happens when you put vitamin K, you know, in a system. But nobody ever says, well, then what on earth should human beings be eating?
Yeah,
that's not even in the book. And so, of course, you know, there's this disconnect. And our position is our diet is incredibly reasonable. And there's another thing that we're getting to here. But our diet is incredibly reasonable in the natural looking in the context of the natural history. And we also see something else, which is that the biological systems in human beings normalize.
Yeah.
They get out of pathological territory when you feed them this diet.
Yeah.
So we know that we're not being a bit unreasonable. The other issue that Alan has made a big deal of is the notion of what about a little bit of this and a little bit of that?
Yeah.
And this is where this gets interesting.
Yeah, this is what I've had a lot of feedback from. Surely a bit of chocolate cake once in a while is all right, or,
right.
You know, yeah.
This is where, and Alan and I, we part ways a little bit here.
Yep.
And for interesting and different reasons than conventional reasons. Alan is very hardcore. So Alan's attitude is, you freaking toe the line. You do everything right. Don't get one inch out of line, because if you do, it's going to just be more difficult for you. And so there really isn't any place in Alan's playbook for anybody saying, let's give a little bit of wiggle room.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, I understand his thinking. And that thinking is actually accurate when it comes to the biology and psychology of the pleasure trap specifically.
Yeah.
So it is, in fact, easier to quit drinking altogether than it is to cut down to a couple shots of scotch twice a week.
Yeah.
If you're an alcoholic, you're better off with zero. Okay. Yeah. And so Alan's position there is not assailable. Now, when I wrote that chapter, my thinking seemed very logical to me. It seemed a little bit preachy, but it seemed clear and crisp and right. And I was perfectly happy with it, and I'm happy with it to this day. However, in the years since, I actually suspected a problem. And I wrote about this problem actually in the end notes in the pleasure trap. I talked about a phenomenon that I have termed the ego trap. And I'll talk about this in the book that I'm writing now, that God knows when it'll be done.
Oh, good. I was going to ask you later if
someday,
you're going to write another book, because I need another one.
Yeah, I'm writing a book that is going to an important concept in the book is what I call the ego trap.
Yeah.
Now, the ego trap, people might start thinking about Doug Lyle's the trap guy. Like, you got the ego trap, the pleasure trap. What other trap is there? No, these are the two traps.
Yeah, okay.
These are the two great motivational puzzles for human nature. They are different, okay? The pleasure trap is unnatural. It is not a natural trap.
Yeah.
This is why it's so devastating. Because we are defenseless in the face of the pleasure trap.
Yeah, we've not faced it throughout human history until really the last 50, maybe 100 years. Yeah.
Right. So you're talking about essentially supernormal stimuli. We've had it for 10,000 years, but not in the magnitude.
Yeah.
And now you have every chemical under the sun available to just about everybody in a way that can hyperactivate the dopamine pathway or endorphin pathways.
Yeah.
And so we've got a tremendous quantity of addicts in one form or another. So this is a big problem, obviously. However, there is a secondary problem that can come about in a variety of contexts, but one of the contexts is in the pursuit of perfection around health. And so this is what I call the ego trap, and let me describe it to you, and you will instantly see the pattern, and you will then see that this is a devastating pair of snakes that operate together, and they're very difficult to get it right, okay? Yeah. The human motivation is designed to try to earn esteem from other people. That's how we're built, okay? And so it's going to turn out that you try to earn esteem from living up to or surpassing what other people's expectations are of you. So if you're a great tennis player and you're going out in the finals of Wimbledon and everybody expects you to win, then when you win, it's good because you've affirmed it, but you haven't gained.
Yeah.
Okay? And so if everybody expects that you're almost certainly not gonna win, then when you don't win, you haven't lost very much. But if you're not expected to win and you win, you have a tremendous gain.
Yeah.
And if you are expected to win and you don't win, you have a tremendous loss.
Yeah.
So it's going to turn out that the expectations that the world has of us are calibrated to what it is that they know about us. And so we're going to have those same kinds of expectations for ourselves. So what we have is we carry within us a set of calibrations as to what we think we're capable of accomplishing and that resonates with what the world probably thinks we're capable of accomplishing. Yeah. And when we do better than that, we get a pride of gaining status. And when we do worse than that, we lose status.
So an example that you won't know about because it's Australian football, but last year the Western Bulldogs, they finished the season 7th or 8th on the ladder. And then in the finals, they went through and won the grand final, which is like the Super Bowl. And
yes.
Suddenly, everybody loved them.
Yes.
And that's because they came from a long way back and won, and everybody went crazy, and everybody's second best favorite team was the Bulldogs all of a sudden.
Right.
So exactly. That's what was happening there.
Yes, yeah. Correct.
Okay.
And so now I want you to think about the following situation back on the savannah. I want you to think of a young man who's 16 or 17 years old. He's just got on the edge of maybe being able to mate. And he's just big enough and strong enough. He's about ready to start to be a hunter. And so he goes out on his first hunt and he gets separated out. Oh, I lost a little bit of context. Everything about this guy is average. Average athleticism, average smarts, average clever. You know, everything about it, he looks average. This guy's headed for an average mating career with a couple of average children. Like everything is going to be average, okay? Now he goes out on this hunt and he comes across a wildebeest with its foot stuck in a snake hole. And he takes a rock and knocks it over the head. And then he goes back about 40 feet and throws a spear into it. Then he drags it home and tells a big story.
Yeah.
Okay. So now there's a big feast and everybody's thinking, wow, you know, Thor over there, we thought that he was average, but looks like he's, you know, special.
Yeah.
So now to the young women of the village, he's not looking like a 5. He starts looking like a 7 or an 8.
Yeah.
Okay. So now what's happening is he is now, the expectations of the village are above the truth.
Yeah.
And this is extra esteem that he doesn't really have. He hasn't really earned it, but he's got it.
Yeah.
Okay? So if we have that situation, what we're going to now find is that when it's time to go on the next hunt, it's time for him to sprain his ankle the day before. He will actually self-sabotage himself.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay? And he's designed to do this because if you self-sabotage, something happens and it doesn't transpire, you get to hang on to the status for longer.
Yeah.
Okay. So actually, this is fantastic because you literally find that the human being is wily enough to be engineered. He's engineered psychologically to self-destruct.
Yeah. This is hitting home for me.
Oh, you bet. Yeah. Okay. Now we're going to keep talking because now we're going to bring it into the modern context.
Yeah.
So now we're in a little small town in the middle of Iowa where they only have like 32 kids graduate from this high school every year. And so for the last 5 years, you know, they've had a few bright kids. But this year we got a real bright kid. And he's been the brightest kid for years. And so everybody thinks that this kid's going to go to Harvard. So they've been talking about this since he was in the 8th grade. And so they're all expecting him to do phenomenal on his board scores because he's so much smarter than the other kids in this school, right? Now this kid is soaking in this esteem. He always gets straight A's. His parents think he's going to go to Harvard. And it all feels great. Now, except that he takes a practice test on the board scores and turns out he scores very high, but not Harvard high. So he can tell that he is not Harvard material.
Yeah.
And he practices quietly when nobody can find out, and it turns out he doesn't improve that much. And by gosh, you know, he's going to be a great student at the state university, but he is not Harvard material.
Yeah.
And they will not let him in. Now, what this kid is very likely to do on the night before the boards is to get drunk in plain sight of everybody.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah.
Because this way they say, well, George, he could have gone to Harvard, but he got drunk the night before the SATs. Can't imagine why he did that. What an idiot, because he's so brilliant. Okay?
Yeah.
This is how he holds on to the status, is by self-destruction.
Yeah, now, right.
Now, so it's going to turn out that this is what I call the ego trap. The ego naturally wants to gain status through achievement, like our young hunter and like this guy. But it's going to turn out that if events transpire, that the village somehow gives him more status than he deserves, then he's put in a position where he cannot live up to expectations. And as a result, he will sabotage his own behavior by sabotaging it in a way that they can say, he can say, look, you can't judge what I'm capable of because I didn't do what I'm capable of. Okay. And this was the threat that I would watch people get into when Alan would put the bar too high for healthy living.
Yeah, okay.
So Alan would put the bar. He'd say, why don't you just do it? To Alan, it's simple because he's unbelievably naturally self-disciplined.
Yeah.
So Alan, when he found this information, it was like child's play to him.
Yeah.
And so he, and it's so powerful and useful that his attitude is, look, just do it this way. It's the easiest way. Don't quit. Keep teasing yourself with the pleasure trap.
Yeah.
And so he sets the bar here. And the problem is, even though he's accurate that it is the easiest way to do it in sum total, the problem is that it may not be doable for people.
Yeah.
Because there's too many challenges. People have too many different motivations, too much temptation, and basically they just can't do it.
Yeah.
And so as a result, they quickly find out that they can't do it. And when they find out that they can't do it, but they're expected to do it, then they start to sabotage themselves. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so now this is what I call, this is the root. This is the very interesting self-protective root of procrastination.
Yeah.
This is why an alcoholic, this is not talked about in drug and alcohol addiction. That we could talk, they talk about the pleasure trap, the dopamine surge, all kinds of things, but they don't talk about the fact that the alcoholic is actually embarrassed of trying and failing.
Yeah.
And then in fact, what they do is they procrastinate.
I get
by
that
saying,
all the time with the people that write to me and say, they say, oh, I'm thinking about trying this potato thing. And I'm not here to say everyone should do it or whatever, but I always get people, oh, I'm thinking about it. I say, why are you thinking about it instead of doing it?
Yes.
And they say, because I'm worried I'll fail.
Yes.
And so, yeah, sorry, keep
going.
This
is what's happening. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So the what's interesting is the following. If we were, so an example of this, so I started to find this out. You know, years ago, 20 years ago, I was sniffing out this issue. And let me give you an example of how I fixed it. So if I had a kid, I had this happen more than once, where I'd have some young person, 13 years old, come into the office with their mother, who was all upset because I hear on the phone that the kid is very, very smart, but he's flunking out and the parents are worried that he's doing drugs or some terrible thing. Okay. And so they come in. And dad doesn't come, even though he's supposed to come, because dad doesn't want to hear some psychologist tell him how to raise his son. So mom comes in, though, all animated and worried. And so mom starts talking to me about how Jimmy's just so smart. He's so creative. He's just brilliant. Well, actually, Dr. Lyle is a genius. You know what I mean? This is the sort of talk that comes out of a parent. And he's a straight A student. Well, the truth is the kid got straight A's once in the last 3 years. The kid is very bright.
Yeah.
But he's not a, quote, straight A student. This is not falling off a log, and it's not a fait accompli.
Yeah.
Okay? So the kid is over-rewarded by his parents. His parents actually think that the right thing to do is to tell him, you can do incredible things. You can do anything. You can do incredible, 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 incredible.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They think that this is helpful for the kid's self-esteem. They don't understand it's actually destructive. Okay, they don't actually understand that they're actually causing a problem.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is what the kid does, the kid sees that if he does his best, they're kind of disappointed. And even they'll say, just do your best. And then, well, if you fall, shoot for the stars. And if you fall a little short, you'll get to the moon.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is the motivational mentality of the average educated human. This is what you're going to hear in Tony Robbins. This is what you're going to hear in Zig Ziglar. This is what you're going to hear in motivational speaking. And it's actually bad. It actually doesn't work. And as a psychologist that doesn't talk to big crowds to whip them up in a fury, but I talk to individuals belly to belly that are struggling, I can tell you that the solution is completely different than any happy talk. The solution to that child's dilemma is when I kick the mom out of the room and I tell the kid, hey, I know what's going on. You don't have to tell me. That kid will look at me like I'm a nut. Like he doesn't know what's going on. Because you know what? The kid himself doesn't know what's going on. Okay? And I say, listen, the reason why you're having this problem is I know your school and I know the parents of the other kids in your school. And you might have been able to get A's before, but the best you're going to be able to do now is C's and B's. Because the truth of the matter is your classmates, their parents are doing their homework for them and they're doing their writing projects for them.
Yeah.
And if your parents aren't doing that, they're not doing their fair share. And so, you know what? You can just kiss it goodbye because all you can get is C's and B's. And you know what? Everything that your parents are promising you if you get A's, I'm going to get them to promise if you get a half C and half B average. And that's how we're going to aim this thing. And those kids look at me like I'm an idiot, like I'm chopped liver that they're going to just take. Okay?
Yeah.
They're excited as they can't believe it. And then I bring the mom in and I explain to them about the kid on the savannah and getting the bar too high.
Yeah.
That their kid is actually self-destructing because he can't live up to expectations.
Yeah. So that kid on the savannah, sorry to interrupt again,
no worries.
But that takes me back again to something in my life.
Yes.
So I was an elite junior kayaker, marathon kayaker, right?
Yes.
I won a couple of Australian championships. So I was quite good. But as I got older, I started putting on weight and I wasn't as fast. I wasn't in the top three anymore. I was more like getting into the top 10. And then I just stopped racing.
Yes.
And that made me think that, maybe what was going on there was that if I stop racing, then I can say I'm a really good kayaker because the last time I raced, I was really good.
Right.
But if I kept on racing, maybe I would have been coming 20th or then 30th, and then I couldn't say I'm really good anymore.
Right.
So, there you go. You're bringing up things from my past as well.
Exactly how that worked.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you can also start to see that you may not have the chops to do something extremely well and you may want to do other things.
Yeah.
So there's more than one thing going on, but probably a big reason was exactly what we're seeing.
Yeah, okay? Well, for me, I definitely think I had it in me to do better, but
yes.
I just wasn't able to get my weight down to an appropriate level where my body would be allowed to perform at its best.
Right,
so,
there you go.
Anyway, back to the mom
Back to the mom.
Yep.
So I explained this to the mom. I explained that what I've now done is I've lowered the bar. So when I lower the bar and tell the kid all he can get is half C's and half B's, the truth is now he's insulted. It's completely different.
Yeah, yeah.
So instead of over-flattering them and putting them in a trap where they can't reach expectations, I lower the bar low enough that they think that I'm insulting them, that of course they can do much better. And of course, in every case, the kids wind up fired up and they can't wait to prove the idiot psychologist wrong. And they come back with excellent grades. And I tell those parents, don't you dare say when those good grades come in, look, I told you you could do this.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell them instead, Dr. Lyle says that sometimes kids get lucky. Okay?
Yeah.
That's where we want them. We want them right in that situation
Yeah.
where they're still earning status by beating expectations.
So I take it the kid's not in the room while you're talking to
No.
them. Yeah,
no.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So, and I have wife after wife saying, oh my God, I wish my husband were here. Because the truth is that the natural parenting or friendship or psychotherapy is to say, you can do it. You can do it. You can do it. It's
Yeah.
all about this. Instead, it's better to say, I'm not sure you can do it.
Yeah.
Okay. If you say, well, I'm not sure you can do it. They're like, oh, so if I really try and I fail, I probably haven't lost any status. But if I try and I succeed, I've definitely gained status because you weren't sure that I could do it.
Yeah.
So this is actually the place that we want people.
Yeah.
Okay? And so this is why this is where moderation comes into this, because when I set goals for people, even though I understand that the concept of moderation in general around this is fundamentally mistaken, the cleanest food is the best food. And the cleaner we are with the food, the less of the pleasure trap force we have, because we're not teasing the circuits like an alcoholic with scotch.
Yep.
We know that this is the cleanest, shortest distance between the two points. However, if we set the goal there, we run into the problem of the ego trap.
Yeah.
Okay? And so instead, what I do is I set it down to what I call 80%.
Yeah.
So I set it there at 80% so that the person can look at this and say, I think that I can do that.
Okay? Yeah.
So I have what I call the starch targets. And the starch targets are starch, fruit, salad, exercise. These are the six starch targets that we set up every day. We have a check sheet that goes for 6 times 7 days or 42 starch targets.
Yep.
I would email this so you can put it on your website. I don't have it on my website because I don't know how to do websites. You know what I mean? I'm not organized, okay? Yeah. But this is what
I've seen your what are they called? The PowerPoint presentations?
My very professional PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah, if you haven't seen a presentation by Doug, it's every slide is like drawn on a whiteboard and then taking a photo. Is that how you do it?
No, I just do it right with a felt pen on a sheet.
Yeah, and then take a photo of it. It's quite entertaining, actually. It's very low-tech stuff.
Very low-tech. So, in fact, we could whip one up now with the stuff that's on the desk. But anyway, the notion is that for a person to set a goal that they can actually feel in their gut that they could do, that they could probably do, okay? Now, we don't set it so low that it's not a challenge. And we don't set it so low that it's not going to help us morph out of the pleasure trap. So 80% is no joke. It's not easy to get your life organized that you do things 80% correctly. It's not easy at all. And so when people do this, what I want them to do is to be checking these boxes. And essentially, as they run a record and they can see that it's happening, they have an internal audience, which is what I'm going to call the self-esteem mechanism, that is watching their behavior. And as they watch themselves produce a set, a record, their internal audience starts to say, you're not kidding around. You're actually doing a good job.
Yeah.
It doesn't give it to you the first day, folks, and it doesn't give it to you the second day. But by about 10 days in, your internal audience starts to look at this and starts to say, this is not a fad for you. You are actually making changes.
Yeah.
And this rise of internal regard that comes is the what you found. From your journey.
Yeah.
And that, what people don't know is they may be overweight, they may be sick, they may be miserable, and they may feel like their life is a wreck. But what you don't, and then you may feel that you have to get a fancy job because that's what your friends have done, or you have to get a fancy wife or husband because that's what your friends have done, or that you have to lose a bunch of weight and look great, and that's what your friends have done, and that's what fancy people have done. And that's what you're going to have to do in order to feel good about yourself. But you know what? That is an enormous mistake. The truth of the matter is you don't have to do any of those things, because let me explain. This is not happy talk now. This is the truth about human nature. This is an instinct that resides inside of human nature.
Yeah.
That if you start to do something that is worthwhile diligently, okay, if you start making a move towards improving your health and your fitness and you are diligent, and I don't mean that you work tremendously hard at it all day, but I mean that you work hard at it for the parts of the day that it's important to do so. If you do this on a consistent basis, and when I say consistent, I don't mean 6 months, I mean 10 days in a row.
Yeah.
If you go 10 days in a row, you have natural instincts that are watching you. They are essentially, they're what in philosophy has gone by the name of consciousness or self-consciousness. The cognitive therapists have called it the internal critic, okay? This is an internal mechanism that observes our behaviors. And so nobody else in the world has to be watching if you eat a jelly donut. But if you do, you feel disgusted with yourself.
Yeah.
Your internal audience saw you do it. Okay.
Yeah.
Your internal audience, if you cheated on a test to get by, your internal audience knows that you cheated.
Yeah.
And so this is your internal audience is watching and is a pitiless judge. You do not have to impress it with your accomplishments, but you do need to impress it with your effort.
Yeah.
And that is what the internal audience cares about. The external world cares about results, and you care about the external world. So your attention is focused on what will they think when they see me in a bathing suit. That is how we think. And we think that the only way to feel better about ourselves, if we're a woman that needs to drop 30 pounds, we think we're not going to feel better about ourselves until we lose the 30 pounds and George sees us in the bathing suit and says, wow, Sally, you look great. But it turns out that's not true. What we are missing in an important concept in psychology that is missed is the most important thing is how you feel about yourself. And that has less to do with the accomplishment and more to do with your diligence. Now, the accomplishment is important. It's important that you see that there's progress being made so you know you're on the right track. But what you don't know is that in 10 days, you can feel unbelievably better about yourself long ahead of dropping any substantial weight where anybody says anything. Your internal audience can say, wow, Sally, this is no joke. You are really doing this.
Yeah.
And essentially, this is the self-esteem mechanism. Nathaniel Brandon said 50 years ago that self-esteem is the reputation you have with yourself. So of all the kinds of things that he said about this and all the fumbling that he did, because he was in an earlier time in psychology and he didn't have the tools that we have today. But that is one of the most succinct and important insights that he came out of that mind.
Yeah.
Self-esteem is the reputation you have with yourself, and you can change that reputation in a matter of days. You cannot change it in one day. You can't change it in one day. So don't expect the first day to give you any big payoff, but it is an investment that will pay off much quicker than you would think.
Yeah, I really, really relate to that because I've said plenty of times that the first 2 weeks were hard.
Yes.
And by the end of that 2 weeks, I started to notice an improvement in my depression.
Yes.
And I started to feel like it was getting easier.
Yes.
Like it was a struggle to eat only potatoes for 2 weeks, but really it was pretty smooth sailing after that for the rest of the year. It wasn't that hard.
Right.
But once I got through that period, and also another thing that I've said plenty of times is that, you know, you mentioned Tony Robbins before. I've spent plenty of times in the morning, like talking to myself in the mirror. You're great. You can do this. You can do anything you want. And all of that sort of positive self-talk that people talk about all the time. And it never did anything for me.
Right.
The thing that really helped me with my depression, there's probably people have been helped by that self-talk before, but for me, it's all about action.
Yes.
As soon as I got through that 2 weeks and I'm like, I've really done something here. I've done something I didn't think I would last 2 weeks, let alone a whole year. I wanted to try for the year, but I got through that and I was like, this is happening. I'm doing something. And that's what I started to think, like, yeah, maybe this self-talk thing is just a load of crap. Maybe we've just got to do things. If you want to be proud of yourself, then you have to do things that you're proud of.
Yes, that is beautifully said, and that is exactly accurate. The truth is that you cannot talk yourself into feeling better about yourself. You must observe yourself improving in your actions in order for you to naturally start to think and feel better about yourself.
Yeah.
Your judgment of yourself is not subject to your PR campaign. It is only subject to an honest evaluation of your effort.
Yeah.
Okay. And the beauty about this, folks, is that not only is that true, that the system itself has no choice.
Yeah.
In fact, if you earn it through diligent effort, your self-esteem will in fact rise. I guarantee it.
Yeah.
Because it's in fact the nature of the neurological mechanisms that are part of human nature. If you in fact earn this by digging what I call the grit mine, self-esteem is made through grit. It's made through making good choices and making them again, okay? And making them in the face of temptation to not do the effort. If you, in fact, go through the process and pay those prices, you will find an increasing internal audience that does not criticize you and does not talk you down. It is not an internal critic in the way that cognitive therapy believes it is. Cognitive therapy teaches that you talk back to the internal critic in these ways. They are actually, even though some of their techniques are useful, they're fundamentally misconstruing the psychological architecture of human nature.
Yeah.
The truth of the matter is that the internal critic is not a critic. It's an audience. And that internal audience is impartial and it will watch you and it will start to shift what it says about you as it observes you change your pattern.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
Yeah. Fantastic. That's another... you keep on hitting the mark with me here. I'm getting tingles down my spine listening to this. But yeah, this is great. So it sort of leads me on to another thing, which I've been telling all the people that I work with in my SpudFit Challenge group and the very few people that I've coached, is that stop looking at the scales for confirmation of whether you're doing things right. For me, it's everything is all about behavior. And if you need a measure of success, then what you said about your starch goals and what I've been saying is, you know, if you get through a day of eating only potatoes, or if you're eating whole food, plant-based, whatever it is that your diet, but if you get through the day, give yourself a tick.
Yes.
If you get through the week, give yourself a tick.
Yes.
And if you just repeat the positive behaviors over and over and over again, the results are going to take care of themselves. You don't need to worry about it. What you need to do is focus on getting the behaviors right over and over. So
this is exactly where what we're trying to do is we're trying to actually have people become Buddhists.
Yeah.
Because this is Buddhist philosophy. Okay. Yeah. Buddhist philosophy is focus on the process, not the outcome.
Yeah.
Now the problem,
that's where it came from for me, actually, from reading Buddhism. Yeah.
Now the problem that I have with Buddhism is that it's a beautiful ideal, but humans are humans, and humans seek competitive esteem feedback from other people. That's why we do it in the first place.
Yeah.
Now the fact is that the Buddhist philosophy and their instruction here to focus on the process rather than the outcome is beautiful, because the truth is that's exactly the right way to do this.
Yeah.
In other words, when I say the process, of what I mean is the little outcomes of the day. I'm talking about the things we don't set goals, folks, that you don't have control over. So you have control over whether we ate a starch and ate a salad and exercise. You have control over that.
Yeah.
You don't have control over whether you're going to lose 25 pounds by summer. You don't have control over that because you don't know your own physiology. You don't know what it's going to take. So why set it as a goal?
Yeah.
The correct goal, the way to set goals, is to set goals over which you have complete control. Then we don't need anybody else's opinion, and we don't need a break out of nature. So we sit there like a Buddhist, and we get lost in the process. Okay.
Yep.
And we find our self-esteem being strengthened and our internal self-regard better as we do the process well. Then, of course, because we are not animals without a higher consciousness that's looking around the corner, we cannot just become an animal lost in its process. We as human beings peek around the corner and want to see evidence that the process that we're doing is related to the outcome that we seek.
Yeah.
We can't stop this, and we shouldn't, okay?
Yeah.
But we need to be patient, okay? We need to be patient with ourselves, patient with outcomes, and the truth of the matter is we need to be following people that have knowledge and wisdom to actually lead us down the correct path. And the truth is this is the correct path. This is the right way to handle the food problems of your own personal health and weight and fitness. This is the way we do it. Any of the variations that are close, whether it's Engine 2, whether it's a potato diet, whether it's McDougal, whether it's Allen's True North, you know, whether it's what John McDougal says, it doesn't make any difference. We're all like within 5% of each other.
Yeah, and you can apply it to any area of life too.
Absolutely.
Like if you want to run a marathon, if you want to be a good runner, don't every day judge how fast you're running. Just did you get up and go for a run? If you did, then you're on the right track.
That is exactly right. And so this, we try to don't let our wobbling towards the outcome worry about the process.
Yeah.
We just do the process, and we know quietly that as we start to see any incremental improvements, we just relax, continue to get lost in the process. It's what I call being myopic.
Yeah.
Don't look too far deep in the future. Just look to the next little section and know that it is completely legitimate and valid for you to be having your imagination peek out into the future and take a peek at the grand thing that we're trying to do. Of course that's true. You cannot talk that out of yourself. There's no way that you should, okay?
Yep.
But what we do want to do, what we do want to borrow from the Eastern philosophy is, as much as we can, lose yourself in the process. That is the best way to run this journey.
Yeah, and I guess that sort of happened by accident for me, because every other diet I'd ever done, my goal was, like you said, I wanted to lose weight. That was what it was all about.
But
then this one, it wasn't a diet because I wasn't trying to lose weight. I was just trying to change my relationship with food. So I didn't have a weight loss goal. Instead, the goal was to go a year of eating only potatoes.
Right.
I didn't care what the scale said. Of course, I was happy when I saw them going down.
Yes.
But my focus was get through the year of eating only potatoes. And whatever happens on the scales, that's just what happens. And
fantastic.
So it's sort of,
you're a poster child for exactly what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, that's, by accident anyway.
No, that's, you know what? And you know the whole thing, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Because this, when you see all these things line up, quote, by accident, we now can look back and see that, of course, these principles are absolutely at play. And it gives us great confidence that we have the right strategy.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm very big on the concept that when we're trying to attack any goal, whether it's trying to do a good job opening a vegan restaurant or whether or not we want to become a fighter pilot, the right thing to do is the goals that we set the right strategy. Okay. We set the right strategy. And the truth is, if it's to become an Olympic rower, we set the right strategy as we vaguely are headed for something over here in the future.
Yeah.
We set the right strategy and we set the sub goals. And our job is to be myopically working towards those goals on a daily basis. Your job isn't to do something magnificent. It's to do your daily work.
Yeah.
And as we do this, we find out where it goes. And wherever it goes, this is the philosophy of the great American basketball coach, John Wooden, who said, success is the peace of mind that comes with knowing that you did your best job.
Yeah.
Okay. That is the peace of mind.
Yeah.
Okay.
Beautiful.
So it's not about winning. Of course you would love to win, but the point is, did you earn your self-esteem?
Yeah.
That is the point. Self-esteem must be earned.
Yeah.
You can't trick it. You can't give it to somebody with a medal that they didn't deserve.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter if a million people cheer you and you didn't actually do the job that you know that you could have done.
Yeah.
Okay. Your internal audience is neither fair nor unfair, but it is pitiless. Yeah. It is pitiless.
So an athlete who wins by taking drugs probably doesn't have great self-esteem.
No, what they have is they have a haunting little problem in that they may get great esteem from the world.
Yeah.
They may get riches. They may get fame. They may get great heterosexual success, you know, whatever it is that comes with this victory.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is that they don't get self-esteem.
Yeah.
Guess what? Your internal self won't give it to you.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
It is a absolute, relentless, honest mechanism.
Yeah.
And it will give it to you what you deserve.
Fascinating. It's blowing my mind all the way. So we've probably got to wrap it up now. We've been going for an hour and 20 minutes.
Yes.
I've got through like a third of the talking points that I had on jotted down on my pad here, but maybe we'll finish with one last thing. This is obviously not a mainstream topic that we're talking about. So what can we do to make this go more mainstream?
I'm not sure because I'm personally not that interested in that.
Okay.
I'm focusing
on the process.
I focus on the process. You know, I've learned that what's important to me are the people that I personally have contact with.
Yep.
And that their struggles, even though they are personally convinced and they know what direction they want to go, that is a very hard battle to go. This is an extremely difficult problem because we're not designed by nature to solve the pleasure trap. And when you couple the pleasure trap with the ego trap, you have an extraordinary combination of potential self-destruction.
Yeah.
Okay? So you have repetitive failure, repetitive attempts, then completely kicking over the table and quitting the whole thing. You see this whole repetitive nightmare in the histories of everybody that you're ever going to talk to about these problems.
Yeah.
So the person that's in front of me or the people that are listening to me, my job is to give them the very best guidance, the very best pathway to success that I can. I'm not worried about the whole world. I'm worried about the people in front of me.
Yeah.
Okay. Collectively, in general,
good
ideas drive bad ideas away.
Yeah.
And so these are good ideas that I've seen in my short life. I have seen these ideas become much more broadly appreciated.
Yeah.
We actually are asked to speak to much bigger audiences than we ever were before 30 years ago. We are now not wackos. We are actually respected. And in fact, even the scientific community finds us a little bit intimidating. You know what I mean? 30 years ago, we were a joke. Now we're not a joke. We're actually sort of the gold standard that everybody's worried that we're going to cannibalize their treatment.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so the world is changing. And long after I'm gone, it'll still be changing in this direction. And so I'm not worried about rushing it. I'm worried about doing as good a job as I can with the people within the reach of my voice.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.